Blog Talk Radio.
Eastern number one to the sun. Thought you might enjoy the entire 3 minutes and 12 seconds of that beautiful, beautiful music. Hello, Eastern family, and thanks for listening and being part of the radio voice of Eastern Airlines. We've got something a little different here. We're adding another broadcast during the week that we hope you might like. The program will be dedicated to memories and stories of former Eastern people, and news from the new Eastern, as we feel you might want to know. These broadcasts will usually be only about 1/2 hour in duration, and we may even throw in a little music, which you just heard, a selection or two. And the program will not be on a talk radio format in that we will not take calls. It will be reserved only for Eastern history and news that we will present during this broadcast. And by the way, the broadcasts are set to be right now on Thursdays afternoon at about 3 o'clock, which this show is being broadcast now at 3 o'clock. And we hope you'll tune in if you can remember those dates. We will continue to broadcast our normal talk radio call-in live show on Mondays at 7 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time. We hope you will like this new addition to the EAL radio show, and you want to come back every Thursday. And By the way, if you can't miss the live broadcast of the show at 3 p.m., don't forget, it's in the archive, and you can pick up the archive by either going to our website, the radio show's website, www.ealradioshow.com, or go to our sponsor, www.repaonline, that's repaonline.com. There you'll see a radio icon, and you'll see usually about five, the last five episodes that we have broadcast will be there. You can click on any of those broadcasts. Usually at the top of the queue, you'll find the most recent broadcast. This episode is episode 271 that we have broadcast now since the beginning of the radio show. Now let's start a story that was written by Captain O.B. Bivens out of Miami. Captain Bivens was based there, and he was a longtime Czech captain, instructor pilot, and a test engineering pilot. And he wrote this story, and it was published in the Repartee book, that the best of Repartee, of the stories that were written by mostly pilots, early days from the male wing pilots all the way up to the shutdown of Eastern Airlines. Again, the story is written by Captain O.B. Bivens, and it reads, Captain Hill is on the line. Thanks, Betty. I punched the lighted button on the telephone. Hi, Walt. What can I do for you? How'd you like to ferry an Electra out to Burbank for a WHORL mode modification? Why me? I thought since you and Fred Davis expanded flight test engineering to handle all the ferry work, check pilots and other management types wouldn't have to handle that stuff. Well, that's how it normally works, but I'm in a bind. I've got a couple of guys out sick and a couple more on vacation, and I thought maybe you'd like to get out of the office for a few days. Walt was right about that. As manager of propeller division of the flight training department, I look forward to any opportunity that will allow me to fly a trip. All the Czech pilots were permitted to fly the line for a month at four-month intervals, but department heads did not have that luxury. They were privileged, however, to fly individual trips on a displacement basis whenever they felt they could leave their desk for a day or two. The displaced captain stayed home and was paid for the flight. Needless to say, he was usually happy with the arrangement. The management captain benefited too, as he could choose his trips without considering seniority. Walt, I tell you what I'm going to do. If you can arrange for me to take my wife along, I'll do it. Man, you sure drive a hard bargain, but I'll try. Well, you ought to be able to swing it. Every time I've flown one of those safaris to California, I've had a full load of maintenance people with their kids going to Disneyland. Lucy Matthews seems to give priority to the mechanics when she makes up the passenger list. Hill knew I had him over the proverbial barrel. Okay, I'll try to work it out. The airplane is number 519, and it will be ready next Wednesday afternoon. Lockheed is supposed to have number 517 ready to return to Miami around May 1st, so you may have to wait a couple of days, but I'm sure you and Lucille can find something to do in Los Angeles during your layover there. Bon voyage, and thanks, pal. Appreciate it. As it turned out, Walter Hill was really caught shorthanded. He had no one available from flight test. Al Beverly, manager of flight engineers, and Dick Merrill comprised the remainder of the crew. Next to Charles Lindbergh, Henry T. Merrill, known worldwide as Dick, was probably one of the most famous aviators in history, at least in the aviation industry. In 1936, he became the first pilot to make a round trip flight across the North Atlantic to Europe. And then on 1937, he flew the first commercial flight to Europe and returned with pictures of the coronation of King George VI of England. The tremendous publicity resulting from the spectacular flight brought Merrill and his co-pilot Jack Lambie a contract to make a movie in Hollywood, Atlantic Flight, starring Dick Merrill and Jack Lambie. Was not exactly a sensation on the big silver screen, but to me, a teenager barnstorming around Missouri with my father in his OX-5-powered Waco biplane in 1937, it was an airplane movie, and I wouldn't have missed it. I saw them all, the good, the bad, and otherwise mostly bad, but I love the airplanes. Little did I dream that one day I would work with and be privileged to call Dick Merrill and Jack Lambie my friends. My first flight with Dick Merrill occurred in 1943 when I flew as his co-pilot on the Miami to New York run. He was extremely considerate and helpful, modest and congenial, not at all as I would have envisioned such a celebrated person. Everywhere we went in New York City, he was greeted and welcomed. It seemed he knew everyone, and everyone knew him. He steadfastly refused to allow me to pay my share of the taxi fare or the dinner check. He would always say, "I've never allowed a co-pilot to buy his dinner yet, OB. You're not going to make me break that rule now, are you?" Many years later, after I became a check captain, and before Walter Hill's department took over the task of ferrying what were considered to be unairworthy airplanes, Dick and I occasionally teamed up to bring Constellations, DC-7s, and Electras back to Miami with one engine inoperative or some other serious mechanical problem which could not be repaired at outlying stations. The procedure was always the same. To determine who would be the captain, Dick would flip the half dollar he almost constantly rolled around the fingers of one hand. "Call it," he would say. If he lost, he would pick up the clipboard with all the flight papers and perform the co-pilot duties, including handling the clearances from the air traffic control and taking care of all the routine radio contacts en route. Some of the check pilots were not so considerate. If they happened to be the senior man, they automatically took the left seat and relegated the co-pilot duties to the junior man. Dick was senior to all the pilots with Eastern except Gene Brown, but never took advantage of his seniority on ferry flights. I won the toss and assumed the left seat for the trip to Burbank. The weather forecast predicted strong headwinds, which would require that we make a stop at Houston for fuel. We arrived shortly after the sea fog had rolled in, but the ceiling was being reported as indefinite, 200 feet, with visibility of 1/2 mile, barely adequate for an approach on the instrument landing system. Knowing how Dick enjoyed making approaches under minimum conditions, I suggested he make it, but he insisted, "It's yours. You make it. That's how the cookie crumbles." He knew I enjoyed instrument flying, too. The remainder of the flight was routine, and when we delivered 519 to Lockheed at the Burbank Air Terminal, we had flown 9 hours and 14 minutes total for the day. The time would have been much less had the Electra not been speed limited pending completion of the wing and engine mount modifications. The Lockheed representative advised us that 517, the aircraft for our return trip, would not be ready for another 4 days, and that we might as well relax and enjoy our stay in California. With that in mind, we checked into the Hollywood Landmark Hotel, where Dick and I usually stayed on layovers in Los Angeles, and agreed to meet for breakfast in a few hours to plan our sightseeing itinerary. Lucia was delighted at the prospect. and I was looking forward to a few days' respite from the pressures of my office. Following breakfast and a brisk walk, the three of us picked up a rental and headed for Knott's Berry Farm. Dick was a great aficionado of the Old West and could talk for hours about the adventures of Wyatt Earp, Billy the Kid, and the other denizens of Tombstone. The Wild West show at the Berry Farm always fascinated him. Later, he suggested we go to the 20th Century Fox Studios the following day to observe the movie industry in action. He made a telephone call to his friend, Harry Brandt, one of the vice presidents of the studio, who advised that his secretary would meet us at the gate and escort us around the lot. The day was truly a tourist dream. It began with luncheon in the Stars Commissary and concluded with a complete tour of all the sets, including one where Raymond Massey was filming a scene. We watched Massey at work for about half an hour, during which three takes were made before a satisfactory performance was achieved. Everyone was impressed by his patience and good humor. He was dressed in the uniform of a Navy commander and was required to bend down and crawl under a low branch of a tree. On the first take, the branch caught his hat, which fell from his head. A few minutes later, on the second attempt, one of his epaulets hooked on the tree and it too fell off. Massey broke into a broad grin. "Damn it, I'm coming unglued." We all enjoyed a hearty laugh as the makeup man repaired the great actor's uniform for another take. Number three was perfect, and that ended the shooting for the day. The weekend passed quickly with more sightseeing and enjoyable camaraderie. A phone call to Lockheed on Monday revealed that our airplane would be ready for the acceptance flight on Tuesday morning, and if we found everything in order, we could depart from Miami as soon as refueling was complete. We asked that the test flight be scheduled as early as possible in order that we might leave for home no later than 10 o'clock. We checked in at the airport at 8, but 517 was still in the hangar. It was rolled out for us just before 11, and we took off immediately. By 12:30, we were back at the terminal after completing all of the many items required by Walter Hill's flight test department. The airplane was in excellent condition, and as soon as refueling was completed, we loaded our passengers, all Eastern employees, and their families, and Captain Dick Merrill took off from Miami. I had been the captain westbound. Now it was Dick's turn to fly. In accordance with the FAA restrictions, the automatic pilot had been disabled on all Electras until the WHORL mode modification was completed. When the airplane returned to Miami, the autopilots were then reconnected. As a result of our late departure from Burbank, it was midnight when we reached the Miami area. The ceiling was 600 feet and visibility reported to be a mile and a half in rain. Dick Merrill had manually flown the airplane all the way from Burbank, nearly 7 hours, and at no time was he more than 5 degrees off the desired heading or more than 100 feet off the altitude. His stamina and precision for a man of nearly 70 years old was almost incredible. When he completed a back course ILS approach and touched down in the driving rain for a perfect landing, I envied him. I hope that I could do as well when I reach his age in about 20 years. In some respects to me and to others as well, I think Dick Merrill appeared to be an enigma. He just didn't fit the mold. During my 3.5 years as co-pilot with Eastern Airlines, I flew with 50 different captains. Most were good pilots, Some were outstanding, and a few were marginal in skill and other attributes. Of course, Dick fit into the outstanding group, but he was different. While most of these men relaxed and flew with great precision, Dick seemed to be working at something every moment. I can think of no adjective which described him more accurately than fidgety. When he was not flying, he was rolling the half dollar around his fingers, or tapping his altimeter, or shifting in his seat. When he was manually flying the airplane, nothing escaped his alert eye. A 20-foot change in altitude called for an immediate correction. A 1-degree excursion in heading caught him his attention and brought action. Yet he never criticized his co-pilot for much wider deviations than he allowed for himself. On the contrary, he usually asked the man in the right seat to keep an eye on him and let him know if something didn't look right. Some pilots probably saw this as a sign of insecurity or weakness, but those of us who had flown with him through serious emergencies had seen the real Dick Merrill, kind, modest, skilled, and self-effacing. We never again wondered how he would react to the stress of such an occasion. It was October 14, 1959. Dick and I were ferrying a Lockheed Constellation from Long Beach, California to Miami following a fuel tank overhaul. Two days before, I had won the toss of the coin in Miami and flew Constellation number 102 westbound. Now, Dick was the captain of number 109 eastbound. It was extremely hot, and smog had reduced their visibility to less than a mile at Long Beach. We had 53 passengers and full tanks of gasoline as Dick rolled into position on runway 30. We were at max gross takeoff weight. Dick eased the four throttles up to takeoff power, and we began to roll. He lifted off the runway and called for gear up. As I pulled the gear handle up, the normal roar of the engines suddenly increased to ear-splitting proportions. Never before had I heard such a sound. It was a runaway propeller. The governor had failed, and probably the low pitch stops as well. Then the number three tachometer had hit the peg. Dick was shouting, but the noise was overwhelming. I couldn't hear his voice, but I could read his lips. Feather number three. I pulled the throttle back, and the noise level subsided considerably. I turned to the flight engineer and shouted, "Dick's command." It won't feather, came the reply. I relayed the engineer's words to Dick. He said nothing. A glance at the airspeed indicator showed 120 knots. I could see the end of the runway coming up ahead, and if Dick could hold the airspeed, we might be able to clear the oil derricks on the low hill at the end of runway 30. Performance of the heavily loaded airplane was being severely degraded by the added drag of the unfeathered propeller. But Dick, with his consummatic airmanship was coaxing every last foot per minute rate of climb out of the crippled aircraft. He was doing what he did best, something many others could not have done. Finally, as we reached 500 feet, Dick leveled off and began a left turn to return to the airport. He had completed about 45 degrees of the 180 when he realized the visibility was insufficient. He could not see the airport, but the ground below was visible through the heavy smog. We still had takeoff power on the three good engines. To attempt to climb to sufficient altitude to execute an instrument approach would have required that we dump fuel over a populated area. We had already exceeded the two-minute time limit for the use of maximum power. Pushing the engines further was out of the question. We couldn't afford to lose another one. Taking all factors into account, Dick had formulated a plan. OB, he shouted above the roar of the engines, I think we're in position to make a right procedure turn from here and land downwind. How's it look to you on the right? He had stopped the turn on a west heading and motioned for me to take the wheel. As I took the controls and began a right turn, I realized how close the big Constellation was to a stall. If Dick had over-controlled or exhibited the slightest roughness in the climb after takeoff, we would have ended up in a blazing heap of metal scattered among the oil derricks. Looking back over my right shoulder, I could not see the airport, but the derricks were barely visible as we turned toward them. I think it'll work okay, Dick. I see those oil rigs on top of the hill. As I rolled out on a heading of 120 degrees, the end of the runway came into view. Although we were approximately 17,000 pounds overweight for a landing, I knew we could make it. From here, it was all downhill, and the runway was 10,000 feet long. I called for the landing gear and flaps, eased the throttles back, and landed. Any co-pilot could have done it just as well. As I brought the propellers out of reverse, Dick took over with the nose wheel steering and turned off the runway. That was the greatest job of flying I've ever seen, he exclaimed. I told him I certainly agreed with that statement, but it was he who did it, not I. That was my old friend Dick Merrill. I'll never meet another one like him. Well, that's our story from the Best of Repartee for today's first episode of a series that we're going to call From the Eastern Files. From the Eastern Files. I think it would be appropriate. This is where we will look for stories. And if you, our listeners, have stories that you want to share with us so that we can broadcast them in this time slot on Thursdays at 3 p.m., just send them in to host@EALradioshow.com. We hope you enjoyed this Great Eastern story selected for today's broadcast. And until next week, we say, so long, Eastern family. We love you, Eastern.
All my bags are packed, I'm ready to go. I'm standing here outside your door. I hate to wake you up to say goodbye, but the dawn is breaking, it's early morn. The taxi's waiting, he's blown his horn. Already I'm so lonesome I could die. So kiss me and smile for me, tell me that you'll wait for me, hold me like you'll never let me go. 'Cause I'm leaving on a jet plane, don't know when I'll be back again. Oh babe, I hate to go. There's so many times I've let you down, so many times I've played around. I tell you now, they don't mean a thing. Every place I go, I think of you. Every song I sing, I'll sing for you. When I come back, I'll bring your wedding ring. So kiss me and smile for me. Tell me that you'll wait for me. Hold me like you'll never let me go. Now the time has come to leave you. One more time, let me kiss you. Then close your eyes and I'll be on my way. Dream about the days to come when I won't have to leave alone. About the times I won't have to say. Kiss me and smile for me. Tell me that you'll wait for me. Hold me like you'll never let me go. Cause I'm leaving on a jet plane. Don't know when I'll be back. I hate to go. I'm leaving on a jet plane. Don't know when I'll be back again. Oh, babe, I hate to go.